Today on the program, and as much as we can this week, the actual economy, not whatever it is they are doing in Washington. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 12th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let us turn a blind eye to the will they or won't they game the White House and House Democrats are playing with another economic relief bill. Also, by the way, to the opening statements in Judge Barrett's nomination hearing today, and begin this program instead with what this week will bring in the actual economy. A lot of stuff, it turns out, and among other things, tomorrow and the days to follow will bring a peek inside the books of the big airlines. Delta, United, American, and Southwest will report earnings. And there is a phrase you will undoubtedly hear thrown around as they detail how they are getting through the pandemic. Cash burn. And among the many questions we have is how long can you burn cash when there is so very little of it coming in? We asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to explain.
A company's cash burn rate measures how quickly it's spending its financial reserves. The International Air Transport Association says airlines will burn through more than $77 billion during the second half of this year. Brian Pierce is that group's chief economist.
Most companies, particularly airlines, just don't have revenues coming in, but they can't get rid of all of their costs at the moment. So they are running down their cash balances in the bank. They are burning cash.
At a rate of many millions a day. Last quarter, Delta reported a daily burn rate of $27 million. But I just found out that airlines calculate cash burn differently.
Yeah, that was news to me as well.
Brett Snyder runs the airline industry blog Cranky Flyer.
I figured cash burn, it's okay, we had this much cash, now we have this much cash. But no, there are all kinds of little carve-outs and differences between the airlines.
Whether an airline includes principal payments or debt service payments in their cash burn will tell a different story to investors. But no matter how the number's calculated, unrelenting cash burn means more debt. Former airline executive and industry analyst Robert Mann puts it this way.
You go to the rent-to-own place, buy a bunch of furniture and burn it. Still have to pay for it, ultimately, but you burn it.
Expenses don't go away just because people aren't flying. But Jack Hirsch, who follows distressed businesses for S&P Global Market Intelligence, says the airlines are in better shape than they're letting on.
They've got almost uniformly more than a year, and in some cases, more than 2 years of running room with cash as it currently stands on the balance sheet before they end up in trouble.
That's because before the pandemic hit, the industry was making enough cash to burn. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You want to work from home? Go ahead and work from home. That's the word from a lot of big tech companies, Twitter, Facebook, Microsoft, just last week said so. The question, of course, becomes, where is home? Because if people are leaving expensive places like Silicon Valley or big cities on the coasts for cheaper, that lower cost of living is going to be reflected in your paycheck. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
There are all these tools online that calculate cost of living. You punch in where you live, where you want to live, your current salary, and out comes some magic number that tells you how much your money is worth in that prospective city. Behind that number are a lot of little ones. Ben Faber is an economics professor at UC Berkeley.
This is relatively straightforward if you think about prices of two items that are available in two locations.
How much is a gallon of gas, a pound of rice, a house?
Where this becomes tricky is that a house is not just a physical structure with four walls and a roof on it. A house comes with a neighborhood. It comes with school quality. It comes with the types of neighbors that surround you.
Cost of living just assigns a dollar value to stuff. It doesn't capture the unique value we place on how we live. And expectations about how we live are shifting, says Peter Capelli, who directs Wharton Center for Human Resources. He thinks slashing salaries for workers who move is tied to the increasingly outdated idea that compensation should be pegged to location. And yet,
this is really kind of the dream of CFOs who think now here's a way to cut pay by a lot.
Because to employees, taking a pay cut to live somewhere cheaper isn't just about the value they place on a white picket fence. It could actually make them feel less valuable as workers. Mary Ann Sardone is with Mercer Consulting.
If you have the same person, they're still providing the same value to the organization. They just happen to be living somewhere else. does that really change what you should pay them?
She thinks the pandemic may force employers to use national salary averages to create compensation packages. Because ultimately, if you want the best employee, you still got to give them the best offer, whether they're living in the Big Apple or Boise. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I mean, sure. Yeah, life's good if you're a big tech company, I guess. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Happens every year, right? The holiday shopping season starts earlier and earlier. Well, you know what's happening this year because of the pandemic? The holiday shopping season is starting earlier. Maybe. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
You may give and get presents, but here's something else you probably won't do in 2020.
You won't be lining up at 4 o'clock in the morning with thousands of other people.
That's the National Retail Federation's Bill Thorne. Instead of crowding store aisles, it's just October and soon you'll be seeing ads for Black Friday sales online. Because of COVID-19, holiday creep is already here. Trini Ahmed with the Yale Center for Customer Insights says the pandemic has changed shoppers' behavior.
Companies are taking advantage of the fact that consumers have now gotten accustomed to the idea of product shortages. Supply chain troubles have extended to so many industries now that consumers kind of know that if they see something they like, they should buy it now and not wait.
With so many shoppers buying stuff online, retailers are trying to start selling now and avoid delays that could happen if everyone buys everything in the 3 weeks before the holidays. Neil Saunders is an analyst with Global Data.
That then becomes a nightmare in terms of fulfilling and delivering all of this product to people's homes.
Yes, but we have high unemployment and considerable uncertainty. Third Bridge analyst Nick Shields.
I don't think you'll see massive splurges over the holiday season the way you have in the past.
And if we do spend, it'll be on stuff for our lives at home, like decorations, cookbooks, and matching pajamas. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Tomorrow morning and every weekday, all you need to know to start your economic day in 7.5 minutes. The Marketplace Morning Report with David Brancaccio and the early crew. Give it a listen. According to Yelp, more than 160,000 businesses in this economy have closed since the 1st of March, about 100,000 of them permanently. And a lot of the ones that have survived have had to change their ways, relying much more on technology than they ever had before. A tale you will hear in today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Elena Navarrete, and I'm the co-owner of La Libreria. La Libreria is a bookstore specialized in children's and young adult books in Spanish, but also it is a cultural hub where people connect with other families that are raising bilingual children. My business partner, Kiara, and I met at the book fair in our children's school, a school that has a bilingual program. So we were very disappointed about the limited availability of books in Spanish in the book fair. So we decided to take action. We started up this business in 2012. Our collection includes more than 4,000 titles. It is challenging to bring the books to the United States. First of all, you know, we have to travel to find the books. So we attend international festivals, we participate in conferences that talk about the book industry. So we don't just bring a whole catalog into our collection, no. We actually meet with the editors, we meet with authors, we read the books, which is very important. What it has been very useful for our business is the in-person experience that we have with our customers, not only in the bookstore, but also we do book fairs in schools. Right now, they are closed, right, because of the COVID situation. So we need to find a way to recreate that in-person experience so we can continue providing the same top quality service to our customers. So this had been very, very challenging. So to reinvent our business during COVID, we have done different types of things. For example, our book fairs are now virtual. We also have an online store. We are connecting with the customers through email and over the phone to help them with their book selection. These are tough times for businesses, and I know that keeping my company afloat requires determination and strategy. But I know also that bad times don't last forever. I'm very optimistic about the future.
That was Selena Navarrete. She's the co-owner of La Libreria here in Los Angeles. You can tell us about your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
And the number you get is going to depend on what you chose to count.
Ain't that always the way? But first, yeah, let's do, you know, the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 250 today. That's in points, 0.9%. That's in percent, 28,837. Got ahead of myself. The NASDAQ gained 296 points. That's 2.5%, 11,876. The S&P 500 added 57 points, 1.6%, ended at 35.34. Euler told us about airlines and their cash burn, so let us check in on those TSA passenger throughput numbers, shall we? Yesterday, a little bit more than 984,000 people passed through airport security checkpoints. On the same Sunday a year ago, more than 2.5 million, down more than 60% is where we still are. And thus, American Airlines down 2.1%. Today, United down just under 2%. Delta gave up about 0.5%. No change to the yield on the 10-year Treasury because it's a federal holiday, Columbus Day, of course. Why are we working? Because we're always here. That's why. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We get a big picture look at unemployment every month, as you know, 7.9% for September, the most recent measurement. There is state and city data as well. Neighborhood by neighborhood, though, can be tougher to come by. But some researchers have been able to estimate unemployment down to that hyperlocal level, and they have found places where joblessness is nearly 30%. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst went to one of them.
Near the southernmost tip of the Bronx, in the back of a very small, empty Mexican restaurant, Natalia Mendez is scrubbing the stove. This used to be lunch hour at La Morada restaurant. People would line up outside to eat Mendez's cooking. Then the pandemic hit.
It was the first or second week of March. I made $500 that week, in 1 week. In order for this place to exist, we need $10,000 a week.
Mendez and her family, who own this restaurant, made a decision. Keep selling to anyone who wanted to buy food and give the rest away for free. What little Mendez makes from sales and donations isn't enough to cover her rent. It goes towards other bills. On the first day, in the first hour, she gave away about 200 bowls of soup. The neighborhood's need over the last 6 months has been crushing.
It hurts me so much. I feel weak when I talk about it. My throat feels like it's closing.
Many in the Bronx have high-risk jobs, like healthcare attendants. Others supported wealthier neighborhoods in Manhattan, cleaning offices or cooking in restaurants. Joel Berg is CEO of Hunger Free America. He says when much of Midtown closed down, their jobs dried up.
And so their tenuous living before this, when they were just at the edge of survival, has been destroyed. And now they're struggling just to put even the barest amount of food on the table.
Ed Garcia Conde has been documenting life here for the last 30 years for the blog Welcome to the Bronx. Conde estimates that among the people he interviews and those he knows personally, about half have lost their jobs.
They've had to move elsewhere. I see a lot of people on the verge of desperation or already at that desperate moment of just, it's taken a toll.
We walk past a long line outside a food pantry, St. Anne's Episcopal Church.
In my entire life in the South Bronx, I've never seen lines at the food pantry like this. It's lines that wrap down the block, that wrap around the block. People are here standing all day, like from early in the morning.
A parked car plays some tropical music, but the faces are sullen. I speak to a few people, elderly who are now in charge of grandchildren, young men who lost their jobs as security guards and janitors. No one wants to talk much, but volunteers say they are getting about 200 people a day, lots of new faces. These are the people who are able to venture out. Others can't.
Hello.
Sí, con el señor Guillermo Vázquez.
El de siempre.
Guillermo Vázquez likes to jokingly answer the phone, saying, "It's always been me." We're on the phone because he hasn't fully recovered from COVID-19, which he got in late March.
Sentí un dolorcito de cabeza.
I felt a little headache, and my bones hurt.
He worked as a condo super in New Jersey. His wife was a stay-at-home mom. Two of his daughters were in school. When he got sick, he couldn't breathe.
As if I were a fish that had been taken out of water. This is how I felt.
He spent the next 5 months in the hospital. While he was there, one of his daughters graduated and started looking for work, but is still looking. His wife picked up some cleaning jobs, nothing stable. Vázquez says in the moments when he was conscious, he worried about what they might do if he lost his job.
They were on their own, I told them. See what you can find. I have a few savings. Don't forget rent. That is the main thing. We can get food somehow, but what worries me is the rent.
Vázquez has been able to pay rent because his employers have kept paying him. But they've been calling to ask when he can come back to work, and he's worried those checks might not last much longer. Vázquez has to stay home for the foreseeable future. His lungs are damaged. His hands get strange cramps. He's tired. When it gets to be too much, he goes on YouTube.
I like to travel the world. I go to Chile, I go to Argentina, I go to Venezuela, I go to Spain.
He dreams of going, but for now he has to stay and catch his breath. In the Bronx, I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
There's that quote about business, right? You can't manage what you can't measure. And we measure things all the time in this economy, unemployment, GDP, lots of stuff. But really, the numbers themselves are only part of the story. The other, maybe more important part, is how you got there. Deborah Stone writes about this in her new book. It's called Counting: How We Use Numbers to Decide What Matters. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Kai.
Could I start with the very, very beginning of this book? I'm sure there's a name for whatever this page is in the book, but you put two quotes up there, two definitions of the word to count, obviously to tally, to add up. The other one, more relevant, I think, to this book is to matter, to be considered. That is, in a sense, what you're trying to do in this book, right? Explain the meaning behind counting things.
Exactly. And the point is of putting those two definitions together is that they're tightly related. In fact, in every language I know, and I've asked people about, the verb to count has both these senses of tallying up things and being important. So counting is a way that we decide what's important.
Which gets to a thing you actually say at some point in this book. I forget exactly where. I apologize. You say numbers are not facts, which is a tad counterintuitive, I think, yes?
Absolutely. I think in this era when people are questioning science and reality, at least those of us who still believe in science and reality think that numbers are truth meters. And I'm here to say that numbers aren't really objective. They're human judgments.
Say more about that, would you? And we should point out here, you are a political scientist by training. You've written books on political science, and you've applied your learnings to that field. But obviously, the thing that we're counting now in this economy is, by and large, the impact that the coronavirus has had.
Right. When you want to measure or count anything, you have to decide what counts in the category that you're counting. So let's say you want to count how many people have died of COVID. Do you count only people who had a positive test before they died? Do you count people who died at home and they had a fever and a cough and trouble breathing, but they never got tested, so we don't know if they had COVID? So those are classification decisions you have to decide in order to decide how many people died. And the number you get is going to depend on what you chose to count.
Here we are in the middle of a pandemic and a political season. Can't turn the news on. Literally, I'm sitting here looking at CNN in the radio studio, and the whole, you know, right quarter of the screen is numbers of people globally and in this country who've gotten sick and who've died. How can we become better interpreters of those numbers, of all this counting that is happening right now?
I think the important thing is to realize that we can't resolve moral dilemmas in political conflicts with numbers. We have a history of trying to do that, starting with counting slaves as three-fifths of a person in the census that was written into the Constitution. To answer your question, we can use numbers better if we always ask the question, who's counting? Why are they counting? What decisions did they make to decide who's in and who's out? Counting is fundamentally political, and when we use numbers to decide what's the right course of action, we need to focus on who's being affected and how by the way we count.
Deborah Stone is a professor emerita at Brandeis University. Her most recent book out this year is called Counting, How We Use Numbers to Decide What Matters. Thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
We've got an excerpt online, of course, talks about the history of how we count unemployment in this economy. You can find it at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which it's really nice to have good neighbors. The Nobel Prize in Economics was announced this morning, as I'm sure you've heard. And yes, technically, it's the Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel. But I think it's time to let that one go, please. Anyway, it was announced this morning. Two Stanford University economists won, Paul Milgram and Robert Wilson, for their work on auctions. Thing is, the Nobels are announced at like 3 in the morning California time, which is how we came to have doorbell camera video from Paul Milgram's house this morning of his across-the-street neighbor and co-laureate, it turns out, Robert Wilson, knocking on the door.
Paul?
Another couple of moments later, Milgram answers through the intercom.
Paul?
Uh-huh.
It's Bob Wilson.
Yeah.
You won the Nobel. You've won the Nobel Prize. And so they're trying to reach you, but they cannot. They don't seem to have a number for you.
We gave them your cell phone number.
Bob Wilson's wife there, Mary with the cell phone thing. Best part, Milgram's response. Remember, it was 3 in the morning.
Yeah, I have. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Understandably flustered, I think. Okay, we are out of here, but not without your Monday moment of economic context. An article in the Journal of the American Medical Association by two Harvard economists, David Cutler, and also the one you probably heard of, no offense, Dr. Cutler, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. They have done some analysis of the costs this virus has brought to the American economy. Two major components, lost health and actual lost economic output. The bottom line number is $16 trillion lost long-term. That is about 90% of what this entire economy produces in a year. Breaks down like this, if you're curious, about $7.5 trillion in direct economic productivity losses over the next decade, $4.3 trillion in losses because people died before their time, $2.5 trillion in long-term health impacts, and $1.5 trillion in mental health effects of this whole thing. Our daily production team is Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.